one of the problems that we have is, frankly, many times you'll find that allegations of official corruption are quite sensitive cases, and for reasons good and sufficient, including sometimes conflicts of interest, were asked by the local district attorneys, at least initially, to investigate these matters. But it may or may not at that stage call for the convening of a grand jury, which is an expensive process.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fryer.
Now, the district attorney, of course, doesn't have power to subpoena people to bring records into his office, does he?
No.
I mean, the only power the DA has is to subpoena a person before the grand jury.
Well, the person or documents, yes.
Yes. So this bill, of course, would give you really quite much more extensive authority than any district attorney in Oregon in terms of criminal investigation. Wouldn't that be accurate to say?
Well, it's a different kind of authority. In fact, before the House committee, we discussed the possibility and were asked by several House members whether or not statewide grand jury authority ought to be given. Because of the historical relationship between the department and district attorneys, we did not seek that authority, although some House members at least were prepared to give it. Granted that that's not the authority, then there's only a limited number of options that still provide you with the authority of compulsory process. And looking at it another way, you could say by the same token that the Secretary of State has a lot more authority than the district attorneys, because the Secretary of State can subpoena any municipality's books and audit them, issue subpoenas to people who deal with public bodies and the audit function.
That's right.
A different kind of role.
But you know, when you're dealing in the area of criminal law and the criminal wrongdoing, I think that there's a lot of difference between that and the Secretary of State auditing some city's books. So one last question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fry.
Can you tell me now again here, Senator Wires was touching on this point. What situations or what statutes give you right now that are on the books, put the charge upon you to take the initiative in any kind of a criminal matter? What do we have?
There are three occasions in which we become involved in criminal matters.
Well, I know that the governor can ask you in, and I don't mean that. I mean, is there any statute in Oregon where the Attorney General is the person that's in charge of proceeding for a violation of that statute?
Yes.
All right.
The statute is a generic one, and it's 180-600, and I've forgotten, it's in the 600 series. It's the first or second one, if you have your
test. Okay. And that pertains basically to what?
Pertaining to official corruption, malfeasance in office, and organized crime. There is no other investigative jurisdiction in the state,
okay,
which is charged by statute with the investigation of organized crime and official corruption in those generic names.
When was that organized crime statute passed?
1977.
And of course, this bill here would not limit your investigation in any way. I mean, you could go out and investigate anything that you wanted to. And it wouldn't fall necessarily within the purview of the section, Chapter 180.
Well, the provision falls within Chapter 180, Senator Fry, and it refers in Section 2 to any criminal investigation conducted by the Attorney General. Okay. Obviously, those words have to refer to such a jurisdiction as is given, and that jurisdiction is limited by the statutes themselves in those three instances, DA assistance, governor orders in, or organized crime, official corruption. I don't consider that a mandate to go out fishing for hunting violations or something that simply doesn't fall within the Attorney General's jurisdiction, which is defined by statute. It's not general criminal jurisdiction. It's very, very specifically defined.
Well, of course, it would be more clear if it said any criminal investigation conducted by the Attorney General pursuant to ORS 180.6.
If that addition would lower the anxiety level of the committee or any of its members, I would be pleased to accept it as a friendly amendment.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hendricks.
Are any of those crimes under 180-600 acts that would not be crimes that a district attorney could also prosecute?
It would they would all be crimes that a district attorney could prosecute. The typical instance, to take the classic example, would be bribery or official misconduct 1 and 2. And I will tell you right offhand that in every case where this department has been involved in criminal investigations involving public officials, and put aside the issue of the legislative investigation in 1981, because most of our investigations actually involve local government officials, which, for reasons sufficient to themselves, the local prosecutors or police agencies believe we should handle. Most of them have been official misconduct 1, official misconduct 2, or bribery. Those are the typical economic crimes related to official corruption.
We sure should look at official misconduct 1 and 2 if they don't get changed some more before the end of the session.
Yeah.
I feel badly we haven't changed that 3 sessions ago. Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Marcy Hertzmark. I pronounced your first name right that time. Last time I said it wrong.
Oh. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marcy Hertzmark. I'm with the Metropolitan Public Defenders. Passing around some comments and information that we had presented before the House committee, I'd like to represent them here in their original form. We are concerned, of course, with the basic underlying question of whether the Attorney General should indeed have the subpoena power limited to the criminal investigations that are under their jurisdiction. Putting aside that question, if this committee decides to indeed go ahead and give that power, we are concerned with the language in the House amendments, which deals with the affidavit presented to the court. The language, as in the House amendments dated May 9th, says the subpoena shall be issued when it appears to the judge upon the affidavit of the Attorney General that the administration of justice requires it to be issued. We're concerned that the phrase administration of justice, which would be the standard for providing the affidavit and the approval for the subpoena, is vague and would not really serve the purpose of having the affidavit in the first place. What we would suggest in the amendments on the last page in subsection 2 would be that the affidavit should maybe issued upon a showing of need, relevance, probable cause, and reasonableness. We feel that that would just clarify things to the point where we would not leave anything to doubt for all parties concerned. And also the language in the May 9th amendments says that the subpoena shall be issued, and we're concerned about the mandatory nature of that, and so we have suggested that the subpoena is still discretionary with the court and that it may be issued, which would be one of our other suggested changes. And we're also
where's the permissive language in your amendment?
In my amendment?
Line 10?
Line 10.
May. I see. Thank you. Sorry.
Well, that's fine. Another issue which has not really been brought up before in the Attorney General's comments, Mr. Hennings and members of the Metropolitan Public Defenders are concerned that if the Attorney General was to have the subpoena power, that the counsel for the defendant should have concurrent subpoena power under the same types of guidelines and standard that the Attorney General should have. If the Attorney General indeed would be able to bring somebody into his or her office on a subpoena, that we should be able to get the same type of information in a criminal investigation. And that amendment is included starting in line 5 of our proposed amendments. The only other change that we have made to the original version of the bill is at the bottom where we have made a conforming change, including the elements of relevance, need, and probable cause in paragraph 3.
Senator Hendrickson.
I just had a question with respect to the counsel for the defendant getting ability to have subpoena power. Is there any parallel for that in terms of the district attorney's powers with respect to discovery in a criminal case? Or would this just simply be a, since this concept that's being proposed for the Attorney General is somewhat novel, this would just sort of be another interesting development? Or
well, the discovery rules, I'm not an expert on this, and I'm sorry that Mr. Crook, who prepared the testimony, was not able to be here tonight. I'm pretty sure that the discovery would be two-way in most other investigations. It's at the stage where there isn't really a case being brought, where we might have trouble, where the defense might have trouble getting information that the Attorney General is gathering that we might not be able to receive in order to make sure that the cases are equal.
I'm not that familiar either with the criminal discovery process, but I think there are some statutes which require the district attorney to give certain information to defense counsel once it comes into their possession. And I'm not very familiar with that, but I believe there are some instances. So I was wondering if this is a sort of a parallel to that concept.
That is the intent.
Well, there was a bill in this session that got tabled that would have given the defense lawyer some discovery powers to talk with witnesses and so on. But I didn't hear all of the answer to her question about other
Well, I think that you can, I think that in some instances, and maybe there's someone here that knows a lot better than I do because I don't practice the criminal lawyer, but I believe that you can get I think you can get certain information from the district attorney if they have it with respect to witnesses
reciprocal discovery as to who the witnesses are going to be, police report.
But that is after the case has started, the information is filed. What we're looking at here is perhaps a case that is not filed yet. This is an investigatory, you know, it's something that's being investigated that perhaps may not be brought as a case.
We have John Hinkson has signed up. He could probably go into that too, more too. Senator Hinkson?
I quickly ask Marcy, what was, could you brief the committee as to the rationale why the House members rejected the proposed amendments?
My recollection of it is that they were more concerned with where the affidavit was to go, whether it was to be a grand jury as opposed to a circuit court, and time considerations, they didn't really want to go into anything else. They just wanted, it just kind of went through. And they decided that, once they decided that it was not to be convening a special grand jury, that it was indeed to be an affidavit to the circuit court instead, that they did not seem to be that concerned with the standards.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pryor.
I don't know whether Marcy can answer this question. I probably should have asked it of the Attorney General, but on the House amendments, I'm looking at line 8. The affidavit and the application of the Attorney General shall be subject to disclosure only on order of the court, and I'm wondering whether that language would preclude the defendant from seeing the affidavit for the subpoena. If you don't know the answer, maybe somebody else can comment on it. But I just now noticed that. It occurs to me the way it reads is that the party being subpoenaed couldn't even look at the affidavit.
It's a good point if you are trying to quash the affidavit.
Yeah. Well, we ought to ask that to Dave Frommeyer.
I would think that the affidavit would be public, but I'm not really.
Do you want to answer that, Dave?
Well, obviously you don't want to tip off the subject of investigation as to the nature of and course of the investigation. Grand jury doesn't have to do that. That's why this is an additional protection, simply to show the bona fides if the Attorney General's good faith later comes into question in the use of this subpoena power. That would be an appropriate vehicle, but it's certainly not appropriate to ask the grand jury the reason that it's asking for evidence, and I don't see why that should be disclosed to a person in the preliminary stages of an investigation. For the very reason it might tip off the subject that that there was an investigation underway and thereby caused the disappearance of evidence or of other suspects.
Well, yeah.
Protects the integrity of the investigation.
Well, but Mr. Chairman, I mean, the defendant's going to get tipped off when he gets served the subpoena. So at that point in time, he's got to make a decision whether to apply to have it quashed or not. And besides, you know, the grand jury has got it's got a separate, you know, it's in the Constitution. It's kind of got a separate power of its own. We're trying to figure out here whether this broad grant of authority should properly be given to the Attorney General.
You haven't asked Marcy Hirschmark any questions about the idea of making the granting of this discretionary to the court. Do you have? I'm wondering what you're thinking about.
Well, she suggested the word shall be changed to may, and I don't have any questions over it. Okay. I don't suppose that would be necessarily objectionable to anybody. I don't. Attorney General, I'm sure, wouldn't object to that either.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Henry Hinkson III.
I appear on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, of which I am the chairman. I speak in opposition to House Bill 2262 as forcefully as I can. This bill is nothing more than a statement of naked power for the Attorney General of the State of Oregon to conduct essentially a Spanish Inquisition in the Star Chamber. So long as the Attorney General can convince a circuit court judge that, quote, the administration of justice requires it to be issued, close quote, a person, including any member of this committee, because some Attorney General someday may think someone on this committee or in this legislature has engaged in some malfeasance in office, can require that individual under this bill to bring their records from their home, which the last time I read is still protected under the Oregon and federal constitution, and require that person to bring books and records and papers and documents and checkbooks and things of that nature into the Attorney General's office, and not only hand over what may be a wheelbarrow in size, that information demanded by the subpoena ducis tecum, but require the person to raise their hand. If you'll turn to page 20, House Bill 2262, to section 2, line B, line 11, subsection B, give all testimony under oath concerning matters relevant to the investigation. And who's going to be there to object on the basis of whether a question is relevant? The Attorney General will rule on the objection him or herself. Who is going to be there to protect the rights of the innocent who may, by some mistaken investigation, be put in the trap of being convicted, although innocent? Who is going to advise and counsel this individual? May a lawyer be present in there, assisting the person that's the recipient of this greeting from the Attorney General? We don't know. And then C, furnish any combination of such material and testimony. I've seen some fine plaintiff's lawyers over here. And I think to myself, well, let's see if justice is a two-way street. We have these plaintiff's lawyers come in here and say, I propose that I have the power to subpoena. Why don't you file a lawsuit?
John Henry, Charlie and I are defense lawyers.
I propose to, as a plaintiff lawyer, to have a power that I'm not going to let this person over here who's a defense lawyer have to do this stuff, because I'm not a trustworthy person, because you can't have it. But I want to subpoena. Why don't you file a lawsuit
without having anything going on, any judicial proceeding, and I'm going to go over here because I suspect the tort in the suites, crime in the suites, a tort in the suites of Georgia Pacific, and I'm going to ask for 7,000 pages of something because I want to prove a tort because there's something came out of the sky and injured my plaintiff. But I'm not going to let Oregon Association Defense Council have that similar power. I suggest you'd say, that's not fair. And I would suggest that justice is a two-way street and that the power shouldn't necessarily just be given to the Attorney General, but should also be given to the Defense Council if it's going to happen. By the way, the whole proposal, I think, should be rejected out of hand. There are some constitutional problems with this that are uniquely Oregon constitutional problems. In the case of Wardius versus Oregon, yes, Oregon, there was an alibi statute that this legislature passed. It had constitutional infirmity because it gave, just like this bill, too much to the government and not enough to the accused. And the United States Supreme Court struck it down as unconstitutional because, among other things, it gave to the government too much power of discovery. And in footnote, I believe it's four, on the last paragraph of that opinion, the court said, we should be ever mindful and suspicious of unequal and non-reciprocal discovery powers between the government and the citizen. And that's exactly what this is. The Spanish Inquisition for the government and nothing for the defendant, or not even the defendant, the citizen accused. Someone presumed innocent who hasn't even been charged with the barest of probable cause. This awful thing about this, in addition, is that it does not require an affidavit of probable cause. What would it be if we had a subpoena ducis tecum that commanded you to produce documents over across the street? A search warrant, wouldn't it? It's the same thing, but we don't even have to have probable cause. Under Article 1, Section 9, no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation. And we don't even have that here. We're going to just render nugatory Article 1, Section 9 of the Oregon Constitution by one fell swoop of the Attorney General's pen under this bill. I suggest that's wrong.
Well, what makes you think we let the Constitution stand in our way?
Well, I'm aware that we're all sworn upholder. And I would suggest that this is so patently unconstitutional that it shouldn't deserve your vote. This other part of it is I call it the I've got a secret part. I'll get to look at it and I'll show it to the judge, but I won't let you look at it. Well, that causes problems under Article 1, Section 10. No court should be secret, but justice shall be administered openly and without purchase. And if you recall, even with the case of juveniles, we want to protect those people from public scrutiny, but under State XRL Laboratory and Publishing Company versus Diaz, the Oregon Supreme Court said no court shall be secret. It applies to the papers as well. There is an Article 1, Section 10 infirmity here as well. With respect to this, what happens if the person is a suspect of crime? And the Attorney General says, well, I'll tell you what, it's just too much trouble. It's too much trouble. The person will go out and hire a lawyer and they'll tell them, don't say anything. You know, stand on your Article 1, Section 12 right not to incriminate yourself. That's still not against the law. By the way, what we'll do is we'll just go out and give them the subpoena and trick them. And we won't even tell them if they have any Miranda rights. We won't even provide them here that they have the right to a lawyer. That could be an ingenious technique. I suggest that that's another constitutional infirmity. 124 years of Oregon history have passed, and the attorney generals of this state, many of them have been fine public officials, haven't seen the need for this power. Some of them may have said that they've seen the need, but I would suggest that there is no necessity at this stage of the proceedings that we have what I would think would be a clear and present danger of virtual overthrow of our government before we throw many of these constitutional rights that I've talked about down the drain.
John?
Yes.
Did you appear in the House on this bill?
That was the first thing I was going to write down. I did not testify at the House. I did not testify. I would. Do you have my letter that I wrote?
I don't,
Mr.
Have
Chairman.
I don't have it here. Wait a minute. Yes, I do. Is it? It's one of the news with the newspaper column attached. Isn't
no,
it?
I wrote a letter on March 15th, 1983.
It's
I don't have that here with
me. No, I would like just to read that quickly.
I'd like to ask you another question if I could. You mentioned the the plaintiff's lawyers here. This says that I was wondering if you did that purely for illustration, or if you were thinking when you looked at this about it says in any criminal investigation conducted by the Attorney General, if you'd given any thought to the concurrent authority that the Attorney General has under the RICO statute to bring a civil action to bring about confiscation or forfeiture of property, and if the bill that we passed out yesterday becomes law, civil penalties, that would it be your? Would you have an opinion on whether this criminal subpoena could obtain, could be used to obtain information that could be used in a subsequent? I should have asked Dave Frohmeyer this, but I didn't think of it until you pointed to the plaintiff's lawyers. Attorney General, you know, is
he thought of the RICO stage?
Planning on plaintiffing. Pardon?
I was wondering what made you look at the plaintiff lawyers and think of the RICO stage.
Well,
I'm sorry I brought it up.
The Attorney General is planning on working with local district attorneys to plaintiff. I think he said something in the neighborhood of $1 million a biennium of clear proceeds. To not clear proceeds.
No, they have some to go.
The before clear proceeds, and civilly. And the committee's been advised that there's an intention to use RICO mainly civilly.
Oh, I see, because he'd be a plaintiff's lawyer then.
Yes, then the Attorney General would be a plaintiff's lawyer. He's going to get something that Senator Hamby's hoping won't go down in history as a contingent fee, the 30% that we sent out yesterday. But I just, it dawned on me when you pointed at the plaintiff's lawyers that what indeed could happen under this criminal subpoena would be information could be obtained that could be used civilly to bring about forfeiture and civil penalties. I don't know if you were thinking of that too, or if you were just making an example.
Well, I just wasn't trying to make an example of those people, but that did come to my brain. The federal government has been known to do this. It is in the context of a grand jury investigation, and it is condemned by the, I would claim, the not-so-avaricious protector of individual liberties, the United States Supreme Court, as presently constituted. They condemn the use of a grand jury procedure to obtain documents and evidence for use in a civil, for instance, antitrust case. I think GM Leasing Company is the name of the case that comes to my mind from the United States Supreme Court. Says you can't do it.
If you want to bring it down to a more garden variety case that I might be involved in, if you've got a criminal prosecution going on for assault and somebody's bringing a personal injury case for assault civilly, concurrently, the presiding judge isn't too enthusiastic about the plaintiff's lawyer trying to use the criminal processes to get the information they need to prosecute their civil claim. I don't think I've had limited experience in that, but probably Mr. Hansowitz and others would know more about that, and Senator Frye for that matter. Generally speaking, aren't circuit court judges sort of reluctant to help the plaintiff's attorney in making out his civil case, an assault case, for example, where there's a criminal prosecution going on?
Well, usually, it's been my experience, if the criminal case is over with by the time the civil case comes along.
But if there's an enterprising plaintiff's lawyer there...
We don't have that kind of Lane County.
You don't? Okay.
Just remove any guy from the bill.
All the enterprising ones are off running for the set.
Okay.
Now, you wanted to mention something else. I'm sorry if I took you off.
Well, that's fine. It gave me a pause, but it was appreciated. I'll try to temper my remarks a little bit more now. I know I was excited before.
You know, the Attorney General said, well, we have to go through all this rigmarole just to get documents. As if just getting documents was something that was a rather mundane thing. Well, think about what we have, this precious thing we have, the right to be let alone. Bill Douglas talked about it in real simple terms, and I'm simpler than he is. The President of the United States says the rhetoric of let's get the government off the back of the people. Well, I just want to look at all your documents in your home. It's just a document. I just want you to empty your purse or some documents in there I want to look at. I just want to snoop around through your financial record. All I want to do is look in your diary. Well, my heart aches when I see that type of an approach. The Oregonian not long ago talked about the U-2 spy planes are flying over Oregon and looking at marijuana plants. Well, I remember when I was in junior high school when Eisenhower came on and denied it that we were using them against the Russians. Well, now we're using them against America. And nobody said it. Nobody could say, nobody knows.